This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author Bruce Franklin about his book, The Most Important Fish in the Sea.
It's a fish you never heard of, the menhaden. It's almost wiped out, except for the good work of the legislature of the state of New Jersey.
We'll also talk with Robert Odawi Porter, professor of law at Syracuse University, about the influence of Iroquois law on our current system of government.
This is a real piece of hidden history, but for Benjamin Franklin publicizing what the Native Americans did with their governance, we would probably not have the two House and Senate set up that we have in our Congress. And we'll talk with our own Heidi Bogosian, just back from Cuba, speaking with people about the case of the Cuban Five. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Bogosian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. We're going to talk with our own Heidi Bogosian, who just yesterday came back from a week's trip to Cuba. Heidi, welcome back.
It's great to be back, but I must say it was greater to be in Cuba.
It's a shock. I know. It's a shock when you get there. It is a shock when you get back. I know, Heidi, you went down because you've been very active in the defense of the Cuban Five.
I went down to have some meetings and to come back and write hopefully some articles to try to get out to the United States media, although, as you know, there's been a virtual blackout in the press about this case.
I know. I think very few people realize that the Cuban Five were tried and convicted and have been in prison now for many years, convicted of conspiracy, the favorite of the prosecutors, conspiracy to commit espionage in the United States. Heidi, tell our listeners, in a nutshell, what they did, why they did it, and what we can do about it.
The Five were patriots who came to Florida to infiltrate some of the many anti-Cuban terrorist groups in this country. They gathered a lot of information.
Did they break any American laws gathering this information, or was this all public?
The only laws that they broke were using false identification, which they obviously needed to do in order to infiltrate the groups. Other than that, the charges, for example, of espionage were meritless. Not one page of classified information was found in all of the materials that the Five had collected.
And what are the kind of things that these groups of Cuban counter-revolutionaries who live in Miami, what have they been doing against Cuban people on the island?
Well, for nearly 50 years, they have perpetrated acts of extreme violence against Cuba. I think also spread misinformation about that country. But they've murdered people, they've attacked the country in various forms, airplanes, boats. It's something that most people, I fear, in America are not aware of.
So the Cubans sent these Five over to Miami really in self-defense.
Totally self-defense. And I think that's a really important concept, that our government refuses to recognize their right to defend themselves, which any country, any nation in the world has a right to do. So in the United States especially has been using the so-called war on terrorism, the right to defend our country from so-called terrorists, as the main campaign over the last several years to conduct illegal acts, including torture, things that the Cubans didn't do. They were peaceful. They just turned this information that they gathered over to the government, and none of it was classified.
That's what's so shocking. I think in retrospect, perhaps naively, giving their dossiers on these criminals, these lawbreakers in the United States who were doing violent acts against Cuba, and turning this information over to the FBI and saying, you know, look, there's the Neutrality Act. There's laws against this. These people are launching attacks against our country from Miami. Please help us. And then the FBI turning around and giving the information over to the prosecutor. They figured out who the Cuban Five were, arrested them, really framed them up, in my opinion, and have put them in prison now for over 5 years.
Yes. And, you know, this government actually had been in conversations with Cuba about terrorist activity. So I think that what happened was in 1998, when the information was turned over, I met with Roberto Gonzalez, brother of Rene Gonzalez, during my trip.
He's one of the Cuban Five.
Rene is one of the Cuban Five in prison in this country. And Roberto, his brother, said that with that decision of the FBI to, in essence, then bring bogus charges against the Five, we were sending a strong message to Cuba. No more dialogue. No more discussion. We will not work with you. And that was a slap in the face. I think another slap in the face and something that you see right now in Cuba is the release of known and admitted terrorist Luis Posada Carriles.
Tell our audience what this person did. He's really a mass murderer.
Yes, he was behind the 1976 airplane bombing that killed 73 people.
It was a Cuban airliner. It had the young Cuban fencing team on it.
Exactly. And this is a symbol. I think the release of Posada in this country, the failure, the hypocrisy of not calling him for what he is, a terrorist, in this climate of we must crack down on all terrorists. Well, we know he was a terrorist. He admits to some of his acts. To release Posada is sending, and again, I will quote Roberto Gonzalez, it is sending a strong message to all Cubans, your lives don't matter.
It's also a paying debt to Gonzalez for services rendered, because for years he worked hand in glove with the CIA.
Yes, yes. One thing also is that the Cubans cite all of our laws. They point out all of the injustices during the case of the trial from, you know, the having it held, the lower trial held in Miami, which was, in the words of the three-judge panel, a perfect storm of prejudices and hatred toward Cubans because of the very strong anti-Cuban community,
as you know. You can't get a fair trial in Miami if you're a Cuban socialist. And the lower court, based on the great work of Len Weinglass and other lawyers, the lower court agreed. It was only when the case was appealed that it was turned around, and the men still remain rotting in some of the worst prisons in America.
Right. And I think it's important to note that the very act of our Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, in saying that the decision of those very wise three judges on that panel needed to be reviewed by the entire en banc, that was a political decision. It does not happen that often. They research, those three judges research details that about the questioning of potential jurors, and even jurors who were not chosen said that they were afraid if they served on the jury, they would be afraid of response in the community. And as we know, one of the many things that happened that was really unfair in this trial was that the media went after all the jurors, trying to let everyone know in the community who they were. And the judge did nothing to stop that.
It was just a sad day for American democracy that this case was so politicized that the Cuban Five could not get a fair trial. When the three courts, the three-judge court below, recognized that, then Alberto Gonzalez stepped in and made sure that the mask of justice was taken off and that justice wasn't blind here, and those guys would still be rotten in prison.
And I think the fear is that this may happen again, that, you know, there are oral arguments this summer. If we get a good decision, will the Attorney General come in again and prolong this? It's just representative of how political trials and whatever the government's agenda is at the time, this now being to crack down even more on Cuba and, you know, really cracking down on travel activities, discontinuing diplomatic talks. And one thing that not everyone might be aware of is that in Cuba, the Cubans are also upset that the United States has put a red neon sign on the Cuban intersection that you can see along the Malecón for a great distance, with sort of, it's like Times Square where they have news clips revolving around. Their reason, our government's reason ostensibly, is to provide news to the Cubans that they may not have access to, world news snippets, along with whatever propaganda they want to throw in there. But the Cubans' response was beautiful. They erected large, tall flags that basically block most of that sign from a distance.
Yeah,
like a little standoff, the flags and the neon sign.
Every time the United States tries to do something like that, the Cubans outwit them. Heidi, one last thing. If our listeners want to learn more about the case of the Cuban Five, how can they do that?
There's a wonderful website, FreeTheFive.org, I believe it is, the Free the Five Committee, and they have all the legal papers, articles. We will link that to our website.
And what's our website?
Our website is lawanddisorder.org. There's some information. There's sample letters that people can write to their local newspapers. That's on the Guild website, nlg.org. It's very important that we spread the word of mouth about this case. And also, one final thing we didn't mention that we have talked about on Law and Disorder before is the denial of visas for the families to visit the Five, which, bottom line, amounts to torture. Inhumane.
And it's illegal under international
law. It's illegal,
law.
Exactly.
They won't let the wives and children come visit a lot of these prisoners.
Right.
Yeah.
It's been years for some of them.
Yeah. American hypocrisy really shown up quite clearly.
In the National Lawyers Guild's quarterly legal journal, The Guild Practitioner, Guild member Cynthia Feathers and her sister Susan put together a collaborative work describing how the system of the great law within the Iroquois Confederacy is a blueprint of the current two houses of U.S. government. The Feathers sisters describe that between 1000 and 1450, the Cayuga, Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, and Seneca nations came together to become the Iroquois Confederacy. And in the early 18th century, they were joined by the Tuscaroras. If the two houses agreed, the Onondaga would implement the unanimous decision, unless they disagreed with the decision and referred the matter back to the council. Sound familiar? By 1988, the 100th U.S. Congress passed a concurrent resolution acknowledging the contribution of the six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy to the development of the U.S. government. Today, we're joined by Robert Odawi Porter, professor of law at Syracuse University and director of the Center for Indigenous Law, Governance, and Citizenship. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Robert.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You teach up in Syracuse, and you're at the Center for Indigenous Law, Governance, and Citizenship. How'd you get involved in that?
Well, I'm a citizen of the Seneca Nation, and I grew up in our Allegheny Territory in western New York State. And I think certainly part of my whole life has been, and my family, connected to our government and our political system. And, you know, I was raised with the idea that I wanted to be a lawyer and represent my nation someday. And as fate would have it, I managed to start teaching and became a scholar of some sort, and here I am today.
Professor, for our listeners, we'd like to explain that the Iroquois Confederacy had actually been a functioning democracy for centuries when our nation drafted its constitution. Can you explain a bit about how Iroquoian ideas of unity and federalism and the balance of power especially have influenced our system of government?
Well, that's certainly a pretty broad and complex question, and we could certainly talk for days about it. But to try to distill it down to its essential elements, it's true that in our legal history, we view our origins of government and democracy as being from time immemorial. You know, we have had a system in place in which our people have actively participated, men and women, elders and youth, in the governance of our nations. Saying goes, and one of our faith keepers here at the Onondaga Nation has long said that when the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria came over from Europe, there was no democracy on that ship. It was already here. And I guess that's the concept in which our ideals of and practice of government, we feel, and I think the Americans have acknowledged, have long been influential.
When the ships under Columbus's command, who was sent out here by a marauding monarch, landed in Democratic America, what was the setup of the governance of the Iroquois Confederacy here in New York State and the territory around New York where the Native Americans lived?
Well, our system is a confederacy, and so each of the component nations, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, the Senecas, and the Tuscarora, which joined our confederacy in 1720s, has two levels of governance. The nation itself, which breaks down in terms of clan governance, village governance, and then across the confederacy, you know, amongst all the nations, there is a unified confederate government. When we speak of leadership or governance, it really does play out in a kind of confederate way, as the name suggests. One of the essential features in terms of the decision-making process was the consensus principle, and is the consensus principle, you know, which is that no major decisions should be made without really the unity of the people behind it.
Well, how would you make a decision, for example, about going to war?
Well, the complexity of a Confederate decision to go to war would require the discussion to first be raised by the Mohawks. And then the Mohawk chiefs, of which there were nine in the Confederate Council, would debate the issue of some complexity, breaking it down into three, and three chiefs, and debating the issue back and forth, ultimately ratifying it if there's agreement, and then having the entire question of going to war being sent then to the Senecas, the other elder brother in our relationship, and then on through each of the nations, meaning that at any given point, a particular leader could veto, in effect, the entire process, and thus sending the entire question back to the beginning. A very time-consuming, but one in which, once a decision was reached, you know, carried the strength and unity of all of the nations.
And Professor, the laws are embodied, as I understand it, under the Iroquois Constitution, also called the Great Binding Law.
The notions of the Great Law vary from one nation to another. In our system, we have referred to it as the Ganeshagoa, the Great Law of Peace, but others may call it the Great Binding Law. These are the English translations of the different nations' dialect of and interpretation. But the complexity of it, which was only written down about 100 years ago during the first transcriptions, if you will, from some of our leaders to anthropologists, that this was kept to memory of our law, and as you know, maybe even in this society, that there are those who know more law than others. You know, we had individuals who really had the responsibility for knowing all of it, and over 400 sort of chapters or segments of the Confederate law.
Let me just remind our listeners, we're speaking with Professor Robert Odawi Porter, who teaches in Syracuse and teaches at the Center for Indigenous Law, Governance, and Citizenship. And we're speaking about the organization of the American government and how it got some of its fundamental ideas from the Native Americans who had a functioning kind of federal system for many centuries on this continent before Columbus ever set foot on it. Professor, can you tell us whether this is true? Because I've read that Benjamin Franklin, who was a printer in Philadelphia, was taken very much with the system that the Native Americans had here in New York State, and that he printed information about this, and this was actually influential during the discussion that the founding fathers had before the American Constitution was drafted.
Yes, that's true, and he said it in a rather sort of a begrudging kind of way, as far as saying, if a bunch of ignorant savages could set up such a complex functioning government, why can't we? And of course, that made sense in this regard, that the myopia which we live in today of history really doesn't help us appreciate how many decades of history there existed before the United States was even formed. And during all of those years, the colonial settlements, the royal governors and agents, had to interact with and did interact with our nations on a day-to-day basis, entering into treaties and agreements and engaging in the complexity of government relations that you'd expect of neighbors. And it goes back to the origins of the Gaswenta, the Tura Wampum, in which we agreed to live in peace, but so long as we maintain our separateness. These protocols of governance were well known, just as we would understand in the United States maybe how our officials deal with the Canadian Parliament or other governments of the world. So too would be the colonial understanding of our Haudenosaunee or Iroquois governance. It simply was a matter of life or death to understand how we did business, and the record is pretty clear that that was influential on the Americans when they began to form their own independent government.
In fact, 30 years after Benjamin Franklin mentioned this concept, John Rutledge, who was a member of the Constitutional Convention and chair, actually, of the drafting committee, opened one of the committee meetings by reading out loud a translation of their Iroquois oral tradition of the founding of their Confederacy, and used that structure, I believe, as support for the notion that political power comes from, quote, we the people.
Exactly. And the record is ample. There's certainly some scholarship out there about the way in which the Americans may have had theories, you know, and ideas from some of the European thinkers about democracy, but where was the real practice of it? Where had been their direct experience with it? There wasn't any, and so it was more looking to their neighbors, us, the Haudenosaunee, with whom there had been such long interaction that served as inspiration.
Years ago, when I was in college, I read a book by Henry Louis Morgan, mm-hmm. Ancient Society, which you're familiar with, and it described the social organization of the Native Americans in the Catskills and in the Adirondacks and areas where I'm now very familiar when I travel around New York State. And then I later read that book, Ancient Society, and Darwin's book, Origins of the Species, were considered the two most important books written in the 19th century. You know, here we are now talking about how this ancient society organized itself in a legal fashion that's influenced the American Constitution down to this day. It really is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, Morgan also wrote The League of the Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois.
Yes, I know.
And was, you know, a lawyer, you know, and really, the first anthropologist, in a sense, of understanding how our societies work, despite not being written down in sort of traditional European fashion.
Well, it wasn't organized according to the principles of private property, and it didn't have the kind of patriarchal family that we have now.
Well, just the opposite.
It was a matriarchal organization of society, and it functioned much differently. And I would have to say, looking back over the last few years, much better.
Well, you know, that's certainly the nice thing to debate and discuss. You know, when you see the contrast between our Confederate structure of government with the Articles of Confederation, you know, of the, you know, the first American government, you know, the parallels are just striking in terms of the decentralization of authority, the strengths and weaknesses of that system. You know, we take the view that, you know, the main material, you know, difference, of course, is that women were deprived of any voice or role or authority in the American government, but in ours held half the power. And thus we felt it was not just legitimate, but much more practical in terms of how to have a democracy.
It took the conquering whites from Europe up until, 1920 uh-huh. to enfranchise women. And when they got here 350 years before, they got to a place where women already had the rights that they had to struggle for in this country. It really is an extraordinary hidden history. Are there any other pearls that you want to share with us?
Well, sure. I think just on that point alone, I mean, I find that my students get a sort of puzzled look over this this dynamic of women as participants in the government, because under our system, it wasn't structured in the same way as we think of it now in the United States. Women had no voice or role officially in the councils, that only men could speak, that the war chief of each nation was designated as the spokesperson for the women from their nation. But at the same time, the women held particular titles. The 50 chiefs in the Grand Council each had a particular title, and those titles were held by certain women in each of the nations as a sort of clan treasure, if you will, that they had to care for and attend to. And so they were responsible for identifying and raising up, as it's called, the leaders from their nations, and also had the power of recall, that in the event that a leader was not listening to the women or to the people generally, the women had the responsibility, who held those titles, of removing the horns of authority, as it's called, from that leader and replace him with someone else. So it was an absolute balance of power, and years later, just recently in the 1960s, when my own nation, which had evolved a form of government to an elected system, was dealing with this issue, many of the women refused the idea that they should have the right to vote because they felt that they had all the power already because they controlled who was doing the speaking.
That's really interesting.
Professor, in your classes, do you talk about the unfortunate turn or the shift away from really a checks and balances system in our government toward a unilateral executive, as some call it? How do you talk about that and explain how we got this way, being based on a nice model originally of checks and balances?
Well, it's certainly the case that the transition to a strong, some might even say imperial executive, you know, is perhaps a reflection of convenience, you know, that in a society which, you know, has a appetite for expansionism, the need to make quick decisions, the process of our original government is just unworkable, you know, that drawing in the legislative or the people's branches of government slows the process down if you have, quote, you know, in your mind, need to make quick action. And under our system, it's certainly true that the time-consuming effort to build consensus to, say, go to war or to take strategic action of any kind took time, and it was very easy to distract from achieving by individuals. And as a result, I mean, and some have said that was one of the reasons why when the American Revolution came, our historic alliance with the British, the fracturing of our Confederacy with the United States siding with the Americans, you know, made it, you know, difficult for us to respond under a short time frame. And that had we had a stronger, you know, executive model or at least something that held us better together, we would have been able to protect ourselves better. But I think that part of what you may have seen with the American government, certainly from what we know of the debates from the Articles of Confederation to the American government, is partly that need for the centralization of national defense into a central government. And that I think that the notion of a president, you know, really from both the history and what we know of today, had way too much of a derivative of having a king, which I know was officially and publicly disdained, but which, you know, in hindsight, you look back on it, and certainly from our perspective as Haudenosaunee, you know, the notion of the president as the king of the United States is pretty much relevant as far as, you know, the long history in which we've engaged with the colonists and the mother country.
And also, and I'm sure you would agree with me, the society of the Native Americans was not a society that was hierarchical, where a very small group on the top owned much of the property and large group on the bottom owned very little. It wasn't that way at all. It was more of a communal society. But now we have, and I think a convenient definition of the federal government that's in place in Washington, it's kind of an executive committee of the ruling rich. And so the whole basis of the way the society is organized is fundamentally different from the way the Native Americans had organized their society.
Well, yeah, and there were definitely different objectives. I mean, and that's where I sort of get back to in much of the literature and scholarship, you know, does focus on the way in which governing structure flows from its function. You know, what does it exist for? What is the purpose of the government? And in our case, you know, we had the tension of having a fairly democratic and egalitarian society, but also one that was very much driven by what we'd call today libertarianism, freedom, individual liberty, that there was a limited government in many ways, despite the complexity of it at a Confederate level. There was a tremendous degree of personal liberty, still there today. And it's a psychological and philosophical and legal underpinnings that at the same time, you know, allows for, you know, individual mobility, you know, in terms of, you know, wealth and political and other accumulation. But at the very same time, the residual of the fact that we're all a nation, we're all one family, one people, means that we have to take care of each other and that there's an underlying sense of social networking and social support that I think today, you know, really, you know, it transcends what I think the American governments provide for their own people. And in fact, just some of the conflicts that my nation has been dealing with of recent late, I think, is a jealousy, you know, that our nation takes care of its people better than the United States does.
The precepts of neoliberalism are just the opposite of those of your nation. We've just very much enjoyed having you. You've been a great guest on Law and Disorder.
If our listeners want to learn more, is there a website at the Center for Indigenous Law, Governance, and Citizenship?
Yes. If you go to the law school website at www.law.syr.edu/indigenous, you'll find us.
Thanks again, Professor.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Very pleased to have Professor H. Bruce Franklin with us today. He's just written a book called The Most Important Fish in the Sea, Menhaden and America. Menhaden's a fish you probably never heard of, but his book is a brilliant portrait of this unlikely ocean hero. And Franklin shows how the menhaden have shaped America's natural and national history and why a single company now threatens their place in both. Today, American Protein Company has a monopoly on the menhaden reduction industry. Every year, it sweeps billions of fish from the sea, grinds them up, and turns them into animal feed, fertilizer, and oil used in everything from linoleum to health food supplements. This massive harvest isn't just devastating one fish, but the Atlantic and Gulf coasts. As more and more menhaden are converted into chicken feed, lipstick, and soap, bigger fish and birds dependent on them starve, and the seas and bays they filter become choked with toxic algae. A crisis is going on. Franklin has written this wonderful book, The Most Important Fish in the Sea. Bruce Franklin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
We've had the privilege of having Jane Franklin on, your companion of many years who knows quite a lot about Cuba. And we always knew that you were a political person and know a lot about a lot of things, but I didn't know you knew a lot about fishing. You know, Michael Ratner is a big trout fisher, uh-huh. And I understand that you're an ocean fisher. Michael's in Trout Unlimited, and that's a organization that's very active in the conservational stuff because you can't have trout unless the area is pristine. You know, we've got this threatened fish that's really the central fish in all of the ocean. The name of your book is called
the most important fish in the sea. It's called a menhaden or a bunker. And I understand you're a fisherman out there in New Jersey. You teach at Rutgers. And how did you get involved in writing a book? You usually write about stuff like on Melville. And now you're writing a book about this fish and ecology and so on. What happened to get you interested in this?
Well, because I've learned about a lot of stuff since Melville, you know, the Vietnam War, war stars, and so on. Yeah, well, the way it started out, I do like to fish. That's my R&R. And here's the fish in Raritan Bay here and out in the ocean, fish with other guys out on a boat, and mostly working class guys. And we were out in 1999. We saw clouds of birds, you know, heard them screaming, and that people who fish ocean and the bays, you know, that means one thing. That is that there's a school of menhaden, we call them bunkers, being ravaged by a school of bluefish, probably one of the most ferocious animals on the planet. So you can go fish for bluefish in that situation, or because bluefish provide a very essential function in the environment, that is chopping up the menhaden for the other fish and shellfish to eat. We went over there to fish underneath the bluefish for weakfish, and there were lots of weakfish picking up the scraps. It's a wild scene when this goes on. I have a description of it in the beginning of the book. Anyhow, so the next thing you know, a spotter plane comes along. It's a spotter plane for a menhaden boat, a purse seiner, and they scoop up the whole school in their net and a number of the fish that are underneath it. And then for days afterwards, there just wasn't any fishing there.
Well, talk about what a purse seiner is.
Yeah, well, the purse seine, this was something, an invention developed by the menhaden industry, the reduction industry in the 19th century. It was, this industry was at the forefront of the industrialization of fishing in general, and the purse seine was key to it. The menhaden, which is a fish, is absolutely crucial for the marine environment. I mean, it is the most important fish. That's why I titled it this way. It's an intensely schooling fish. This is their main defense against all the predators that are feeding on them, which is a good defense, except against the most efficient predator on the planet. That's us. So the purse seine takes advantage of this schooling. The way it works is, Two boats start out right next to each other, and they actually share the net. It's a huge net. And then the boats start out in opposite directions, and they move out in a great big circle around the school, and all the while peeling out this net, which is enclosing the school from the sides. And then when the circumference is complete, they've got the whole school surrounded, then they drop essentially a big weight down there, which closes the bottom of the net. That's why it's called a purse seine, because the fish are now in a purse. And this gives them the ability to take the whole school at once. In the modern fishery, in the reduction fishery, what they do next is they put in a gigantic tube, essentially, that's hooked to a pump on board the ship that's dispatched the two boats, and then they just pump what's now a solid mass of fish into the hold of the vessel.
What struck me is you give some statistics, like 90% of the biomass has been obliterated because of this kind of industrial overfishing.
The biomass of this particular fish, Michael? Or as Bruce saying something
not
else.
This, but others too that rely on it. So my question to you is, Bruce, what is the central role that this menhaden fish? I mean, I didn't even heard of a menhaden fish. Of course, I'm from Wisconsin. You say it plays a central role in the ecology of the oceans. How does it do that? And what's been the result of this Omega Protein Company, which is like the big capitalist outfit in the area, sucking up all these fish? What does it do? And what's happened as a consequence of it getting obliterated?
Well, the astonishing thing about this fish, this is, again, you know, why I call this book the most important fish in the sea, is it's not just one role, it's two roles, both of which are absolutely crucial. This fish is a filter feeder. Each fish filters at least 4 gallons of water a minute, and they swim in these vast schools. Used to be solid. And so they swim along with their mouths open, just slurping up primarily algae, that is what the biologists call phytoplankton. Plankton just means drifting. These are little tiny plants, often microscopic, that drift. It's phyto means plant. So they slurp up that phytoplankton. They slurp up the detritus in the water. They slurp up the cellulose that's in the water. This is important because the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast are low-lying coasts, which are naturally nutrient-rich, especially pouring lots of nitrogen into our bays and estuaries and the inshore waters, stimulating the growth of algae. And the menhaden, along with oysters, were the two great checks on this. With the devastation of the oysters and now the devastation of the menhaden, this allows the algae to bloom, these vast, what they call algal blooms, some of which are very dangerous, directly toxic, but all of which are devastating to the environment because they die, drop down, and as they decompose, they suck all the oxygen out of the water. So you get, you don't have any dissolved oxygen, DO. This causes hypoxia, and sometimes that is very low oxygen, and sometimes anoxia, which means no oxygen at all. So all kinds of life no longer can flourish in these waters.
Has this happened, actually, on our coasts yet?
All over, and the Chesapeake is the biggest disaster area of all. I mean, it's an absolute tragedy what's happening there. It's an ecological collapse.
And it's mainly because of the removal of this fish, is that right?
Well, first they destroy the oysters. You know, this is
oh, right, big, I knew that this, part,
this,
right.
This is the greatest habitat for oysters in the entire world. Right. And now we've got 1% of the oyster population.
Yeah, I used to go along the Hudson River, and you could just fresh oyster stands everywhere.
Right.
100 years ago, or 150.
Yeah, right. Well,
when the Europeans got here, they were as big as dinner plates all over.
And here, Raritan Bay, New York Harbor, Delaware Bay, Chesapeake Bay, the oysters, the oyster reefs were so thick they were a serious hazard to navigation. Well, that's gone. The second thing about the filtering is that in slurping up the detritus and the cellulose, they're clarifying the water so that this allows sunlight to penetrate down and stimulate the healthy growth at the bottom. That's the plants with roots down there that the fish and shellfish need for habitat. So the first function is filtering our waters and keeping them clean and healthy. And they're absolutely essential for this.
And we're talking with H. Bruce Franklin. He's the author of a very important book called The Most Important Fish in the Sea. Bruce is a very important professor, political writer. This is an unusual book for him, but of course it has an underlying politics that goes along with Bruce's thinking.
Okay, so, thank you. So here we are. These fish now, they've gotten big, this juvenile fish. Now they're full of this algae. Well, what is this algae? It is now omega-3 fatty acids. So out they go into the ocean, or some of them still in the bay, where they become the most important source of food for practically every valued fish and shellfish out there. The great 19th century ichthyologist G. Goodbrown said that if you're dining on Atlantic fish, you're eating nothing but menhaden. And he was only exaggerating.
The striped bass eat it. The tuna eat it.
It's not just every fish. It's all the shellfish. It's all the marine birds, the toothed mammals out there. And you have to sort of be out there to see this scene and realize that all these animals are going berserk in their obsession to eat menhaden. Why? Because menhaden are their source of the omega-3 fatty acids. They can't synthesize it any more than we can.
Omega-3
fatty acids.
What does it do for us?
Well, the American Heart Association says that we really need it for healthy hearts. It evidently is very important for the development of our brain and the continued health of our brain. You know, you can get some from other foods. You know, there are some terrestrial foods that provide it for us, but the richest sources of these are the carnivorous fish, and the reason that there's, like, bluefish is a good example. The more oily the fish, the better, because the oil is the sign that they're full of these omega-3 fatty acids. So, and where do they get them? They get them from the menhaden.
Bruce, let's fast forward a little bit. These fish have just been devastated. I read in your book that there's the one bad character in all of this is this company called Omega Protein. What do they do, and what do people like you try to do to stop it?
This fight's been going on since the late 1860s, as people realized that there was an industry developing that was destroying the marine environment, and it's called the reduction industry. And the reason it's called the reduction industry is because it takes this absolutely crucial, essential part of the marine ecology and reduces it to industrial commodities. That is, you're seeing capitalism. Maybe it's not most irrational form, but it's a real good candidate for the most irrational form of capitalism, right up there.
Why do you say that?
And because, you know, if the fishery industry goes out there and they're catching fish to eat, well, at least, you know, it's fish to eat. But people don't eat menhaden. All this industry has ever done is to catch vast quantities of this fish to turn them into industrial commodities that are just a little bit cheaper than other industrial commodities that serve exactly the same purpose.
You know, well, they make lipstick and linoleum out of them, fertilizer,
chicken feed, cat food. There is no excuse for this industry existing.
Well, why does
because it is so rapacious. Because its only advantage industrially has always been its cheapness, and it's cheap because of the supply. But so as they've destroyed the supply, the industry has kept collapsing ever since the most boom periods, especially after the Civil War and then after World War II when the airplane and other technology came in. And as it's collapsed, it's become monopolized. So we have this one company, which is originally founded by George H.W. Bush, called Zapata Oil and Gas, which eventually got taken over and converted into nothing but a menhaden reduction company, which now has a total 100% monopoly on the entire fishery on the Atlantic coast.
Wow.
And almost 100% monopoly on the fishery on the Gulf Coast. They have one tiny competitor. And with the total number of employees of this company, it numbers in the hundreds, and most of those are seasonal employees. So what is the purpose? How do we allow this to exist? And the reason we allow it to exist, I think it gets back to, Michael, what you were saying before. You never heard of this. I mean, when I was working on this book, people would say to me, "Hey, Bruce, what are you working on these days?" And I say, "Menhaden." I say, "Menhaden? No, menhaden. It's a fish. Wait, I never heard of that."
Well, hey, Bruce, let me remind our listeners who just tuned in. We're talking with Bruce Franklin, professor at Rutgers, recreational fisherman. He's just written a really fine book called "The Most Important Fish in the Sea." This fish has been threatened by a company called Omega Protein. And Bruce, tell us what people have done to fight Omega Protein, and if you had to draw a balance sheet, how are we doing?
Well, as I said, the fight's been going on since the late 1860s, long before Omega Protein existed. We're not doing real well on this overall. Now, it's true that every single state along the Atlantic, with the exception of Virginia and North Carolina, have now banished the reduction fisheries from state waters. But the Chesapeake, which is the absolute vital nursery for this fish, is the Virginia waters of the Chesapeake are wide open because Omega has the Virginia legislature in its pocket. And I mean, this has all been documented, how they've essentially bribed, that is, campaign financed, all the key legislators and the Attorney General of the state in order to prevent any kind of regulation. There's an organization called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which is in charge of fishery management all along the Atlantic coast, and they manage each species of fish. This is the only fish under ASMFC management which has never been regulated. There is absolutely no limit on their catch. And as a result, they're out there fishing until, we'll repeat what we did to the oysters, until there aren't any fish left. And there's a significant possibility that this fish could actually become functionally extinct. I mean, as bizarre as that sounds, but it's possible. As it is, the fish has been so reduced from its state in the natural environment that parts of that environment are collapsing.
Bruce, when I read your book, I was reminded of just the sick feeling I had the first time I saw the clip on TV of the polar bear sitting on the ice and the ice disintegrating and the polar bears landing in the water with no place to go. And when I read your book, it was the same kind of graphic depiction of, you know, this kind of end of the earth scenario because of what this corporation is doing. If people want to get involved in this, I would recommend they read Bruce Franklin's book, The Most Important Fish in the Sea. But Bruce, do you have any other suggestions on what you and people you're working with are doing?
There are several things that need to be done. Anybody who's living in Virginia and North Carolina really needs to get going and get this fishery stopped in Virginia and North Carolina. You know, then secondly, along the Gulf Coast, you know, we have to get this thing regulated. We got to go beyond that. We have to get the government into this act. This has been a fight that's been going on since the 1870s. At one point, the government was going to get into the act, and for various reasons that I go through, historical reasons in the book, that was stopped. There are representatives in Congress who are aware of the situation, you're trying to do something about it. On the other hand, I hate to say this, but the supplemental bill for funding the Iraq War, you know, had all this pork put into it, and lo and behold, what do we find in there? $120 million budgeted to support the shrimp and menhaden industry on the Gulf Coast.
Amazing.
And now those are the two most destructive fisheries on that coast. And that was put in there under the pretext of recovery from Katrina. Well, I mean, the people who are really suffering from Hurricane Katrina is not omega protein. That money, the money budgeted for the menhaden in the Gulf Coast will go directly to omega protein. So this is something that everybody who hears this can do something about. You should write to your representatives in Congress, especially the Democratic representatives, and get them to get that out of whatever funding bill is going to go eventually to our great president for his signature.
Well, that's great, Bruce. I mean, this book sounds just fantastic. We want to recommend it to all our listeners. It's by H. Bruce Franklin, called The Most Important Fish in the Sea. Read it and get very worried and get in touch with your member of Congress. And after you finish that, you can read some of Bruce's other great books.
18 of them.
Vietnam in America, A Documented History, Prison Writings in the 20th Century. Well, you get the picture. He's a great writer, very political, and this book will not let you down.
Well, thank
you, Bruce.
You, Michael, and Michael.
Okay, take it easy.
Thank you. Say hello to Jane for us.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
On the state of our war against the American people. We're mounting a sustained campaign to crack down on every American and every person of every faith and every nation and to bring them to justice. All missions are being executed according to plan without warning or provocation. Americans are being swept up in an international dragnet. Thousands of FBI agents are on the trail of other citizens here and abroad. It has everything to do with hate and evil and murder and prejudice. America's strong, strong, strong.
Federal agents, we are armed!
What would you do if you knew all the things we know? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away to? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would
Wouldn't you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away?
I see a message from the government. Like every day, I watch it and listen and call them all suckers. They wanted me about Osama or whatever. Picture me buying the scam, I said never. You in tune to a hard truth, soldier spitting. I stay committed, gives a f to die, I lose commission. It's all a part of fighting devil state mind control. And all about the battle for your body, mind, and soul. And now I'm hoping you don't close your mind so they shape you. Don't forget they made us slaves, gave us AIDS and raped us. Another Bush season mean another war for profit. All in secret so the public never seek to stop it. Deep. 666, all connected. Stole the votes, they control the race and take elections. It's the Skull and Bones Freemason Kill Committee. See the dragon get in every city.
What would you do if you,
what would you do?
Knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn it off?
Now ask yourself, who's the one with the most to gain? 4-9-11, stand his name. Now even waving flags like they lost their mind. Everybody got opinions, but don't know the time. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is making enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt. And take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Ain't nothing changed but more colored people locked in prison. These pigs still beat us, but it seems we forgetting. But I remember 4 September how these devils do it. Giuliani asked Diallo how he doing. We in the streets, holler jail to the thief. Fall up waving flags, bring these dragons to their knees. Oil, blood, money make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being Ashcroft, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.